and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the economic fallout from Russia's intervention in Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea that has caused the Russian stock market to plummet and the ruble to lose 10% of its value. Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and resources and resource threats, joins us to discuss the economic hits Russia is taking now, with much more to come if the situation escalates. Then we will speak with the granddaughter of the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, who gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School, joins us. We will discuss rising nationalist fever in Russia, inflamed by the Putin-controlled media's propaganda that Ukrainian right-wing nationalists are threatening Russian speakers in Ukraine and that the new government in Kiev is controlled by neo-Nazis and anti-Semites, even though Ukraine's new prime minister, Yatsenyuk, is Jewish. Then finally, we will speak with Mike Lofgren, a 28-year veteran House and Senate senior staffer who just wrote an essay published at BillMoyers.com, Anatomy of the Deep State, which outlines a hybrid of corporate America and the national security state, which is out of control and unconstrained. We will discuss the deep state as the thread that runs through the history of the last three decades, explaining how we have deregulation, the financialization of the economy, the Wall Street bust, the erosion of civil liberties, and perpetual war. And joining us now is Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and future resource threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Sullivan.
Yes, hello.
And clearly Russia's taking a hit since its intervention in Ukraine on March the 3rd. It has already been dubbed Black Monday. The Russian stock market plummeted 12%. The ruble has fallen 10% in 2 months, causing expensive intervention by Russia's central bank. Apparently up to $15 billion is being spent. And on top of that, the British Prime Minister is now saying that Russia miscalculated. What's your sense?
Well, depends on what Russia and Mr. Putin and his gang are interested in. In many ways, it looks like they want to get back the former parts of the Soviet Union and piece it back together again for another Russian empire as such. But yes, it's been very costly for them. Russia's economy is mostly based on minerals and oil. They export very little. They have almost no industry. It's a fragile economy if the pipeline systems and the middle trade are hit pretty hard. The stock market was hit because Russia was seen as an increasingly risky place, and for good reasons. People left the ruble and headed toward safer currencies like the yen and the dollar and in the euro. And, of course, that's going to knock the ruble even further down if things get worse. And this could be just the beginning of the crisis. Or are there multiple crises?
So what is then, my understanding is that Putin's calculus was based upon what the generals were telling him, that now with this change of government in Ukraine, NATO could be on our border, our lease agreement with the Black Sea Fleet could be in jeopardy, and he didn't listen to his businessmen, the oligarchs that he regulates, nor did he listen to his diplomats. Is that your understanding?
Well, it's very hard to tell in a somewhat non-transparent environment that exists there what exactly is going on here. But if the general has advised him to do this, they weren't really thinking this through, and they probably assumed that the United States and certainly international investors would not react as they could. Maybe the Russian general should take some economics classes. Because the real chink in the armor for Russia right now is their economy. They can move troops in and they can have them without Russian insignias, actually being driven around with trucks with Russian license plates. That's not exactly an opaque way of doing things. But the possibility for this going south is there. The oligarchs are probably somewhat upset, and as you said, they are regulated. If they get offline, Putin will go after them. but they're getting hit in their pocketbooks.
And this is true, obviously, of the Ukrainian oligarchs. But my understanding is that one of the reasons why Putin freaked out so much about the ousting of his puppet, if you will, Yanukovych, who he obviously had contempt for, but nevertheless, it was his guy, that he pressured Yanukovych to scuttle the EU deal, in part because the EU deal required transparency on Gazprom's dealings with the Ukrainian government. And we know how much, we're getting an idea now, how much Yanukovych stole. He basically bankrupted Ukraine's treasury. But Tymoshenko, Yulia Tymoshenko, who's often thought as perhaps a replacement for Yanukovych, she apparently made hundreds of millions of dollars out of these shady deals with Gazprom. So give me an idea about whether or not that is a problem for Putin. He doesn't want any of Gazprom's books exposed to the world.
Well, Gazprom is actually a publicly traded stock.
Right.
But it's not within the SEC regulations in the U.S., nor in the regulations for stock transparency for the U.K., for example. Gazprom is really an extra arm of the foreign policy establishment of the Kremlin. If the books were wide open, I think we would find out that there's a lot more happening there than anyone really wants to know about. With regard to payoffs to the former leadership of Ukraine, this guy did very well. With regard to payoffs to people who were voting for the recent separation of the Crimea, I'm sure this was already set up a long time ago. Take a look at the map. You'll see Krasnodar. Sochi is just a bit south of the road that goes across from Crimea into the Krasnodar region. My sense is that Putin may have been planning this while he was enjoying the Olympics.
Explain further. What is his goal then?
His goal is to essentially separate out a good part of eastern Crimea. This is my guess anyway. Again, I'm not inside of the fellow's brain. And essentially make the Ukraine that may split off from him landlocked. Most of the trade, agricultural, and this is an important part of the economy of Ukraine, agricultural trade, energy trade, steel trade, goes out through the ports in eastern Ukraine. Odessa, Sevastopol, and so forth. These are very important for the economy of Ukraine. So essentially, if he takes all of eastern Ukraine, landlocking them, essentially taking a good part of their economy away, and then later on with the development of the South Stream pipeline, or even earlier, essentially shutting down the natural gas revenue from transport to the rest of Europe for Ukraine, he's essentially shattered their economy and, quote, taught them a lesson. Also, he wants to keep that fleet in the Black Sea. They have very little alternative, especially after the port of Tartus in Syria did not work out for them. It's important for the oil trade and other trade for Russia to keep the Crimea and those ports within its control.
So, again, I'm speaking with Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and an adjunct professor in security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and future resource threats. So if we get, though, into a situation of sanctions and reciprocity from Putin, where does this go? I mean, at the end of the day, it may take a few years for Europe to diversify its portfolios of where it buys natural gas from. Germany, of course, is most dependent, but then they have their own pipeline now, the Nord Stream. The rest of Europe is less dependent and would take a little while for Qatari gas and American gas to get there through. They have to build a lot of LNG terminals, I understand. Why would Putin want that? At the end of the day, he's going to lose all of his European markets.
Well, some of this could be backfilled a lot faster because a lot of LNG regasification capacity, and that's the ability for the liquid gas in the tankers to be turned back into a gas and then sent into the pipelines. This was built up just before the start of the recession and finished about 2010, 2011. So there's excess capacity there. With that excess capacity, more LNG tankers could come in and backfill some of it, but not all of it. For the U.S., it could take anywhere from 4 to 8, depending on the legal issues and the NGOs and suits, to 10 years to get some of these things in line, unless there's a fast-track way of doing this. The Israeli gas could be developed maybe 5 to 8 years, LNG facility possibly 6 years at the fastest. Yeah, this stuff takes time. It's not going to be a quick solution to diversify, but clearly this is a lesson for the Europeans and many others, including the Turks, who are also at risk because the Blue Stream pipeline that goes from Russia to Turkey goes through eastern Ukraine. So there's lots of energy issues coming around the bend, which really should drive and should require the development of a world natural gas market. A lot more LNG liquefaction capacity being built, many more LNG tankers being built, and certainly for Europe and Turkey and many others who have been reliant on the Russians for natural gas, build more regas facilities, so those LNG tankers can dock at your ports and you can take the gas off and keep your people warm, your electricity running, and your industry going.
But again, all of this would indicate that what Putin is doing is counterintuitive. If he's going to lose these markets, which are the source of most of Russia's income.
They're also heading east. They're building pipeline systems and growing their interest in the east with China in particular and to some extent Japan. But the Japanese are getting nervous about this situation too because they're looking at Russia as a non-reliable source. And of course, if you take a look at history, Japan and Russia have had some difficult moments. Yes, it does seem counterintuitive. This, in the end, if it's followed through by the Europeans, by the Americans and others in this development of a world gas market, could break the back of Gazprom and significantly damage the economy of Russia. In that way, it seems illogical if it were an economic decision, but it seems to be a personal and semi-strategic decision that may backfire on him badly.
Well, when you say, Paul Sullivan, that the Russians are moving east, they are developing Siberia, I understand, but they need Western technology to help them with that. They've been forced to make deals with ExxonMobil. My understanding, though, is that China is making separate deals with the stands where the gas is coming from, Uzbekistan, and they're building pipelines directly across the south into China, through China's west. So I don't see that. It looks as if the Chinese are hedging their bets by making deals with the stands, the former Soviet republics, and that the Siberian development is a few years off, if not decades off.
Well, the Turkmen pipeline is already down, and the Kazakh oil pipeline is already down. The Chinese are always going to hedge their bets. They're thirsty for energy. They're going to be looking all over the world, Australia, Malaysia, Canada, the U.S., you name it. Of course, they're hedging, and it will take time for the developments in eastern Siberia to get moving forward. So this is a sort of a decision that will have short-term costs that possibly is hoping he can correct with long-term strategy. And the money that they're going to be getting from the eastern markets may not be as great as what they could get from the western markets if they were more reasonable, thoughtful, and rational in their decision-making. With regard to the western technology, the ExxonMobils, the BPs, and so forth, they need that technology, and one set of sanctions that could really put a pinch on things is sanctions on technology for natural gas development. And that would make things quite complicated. But the question is, how much are the Europeans going to play ball on this? You mentioned earlier that the Germans are quite reliant on Russian gas. They're also quite ambivalent about what to do next. When you're that reliant on a country for your energy resources, you're going to be more careful in your reactions.
Well, it does seem, though, that there's no way around the fact that Crimea was a part of Ukraine and that the Ukrainians are not going to honor or accept this petition, this referendum that's coming up. I mean, to my mind, I'm astounded at how many people in the West are accepting Russia's propaganda, which is that the new Ukrainian government is full of anti-Semites and fascists, when it seems to be fairly broadly based. There are some unsavory characters in there, but they don't seem to be in anything like a majority, where in contrast to that, the previous Russian model was the crook who stole the treasury, who was driven out by people power, and the people that the Russians are putting up down in Crimea. The Prime Minister Aksionov is a former gangster known as the Goblin, a minor gangster at that. Konstantinov, the Speaker of the Crimean Parliament, is a total crook who scammed a whole bunch of people into putting money up for apartment buildings which weren't built. These are the kind of people that Putin's offering. I don't see that sustainable in the long run.
Well, this is the same playbook, or similar to the playbook that was in Georgia in 2008. I mean, they get a piece of territory from Georgia, propaganda followed by putting their own people in, whether they're crooks or not. It's a question of which Ukrainians are going to support this. If all you've been barraged with regard to information is what you described as Putin's view on this, what's the alternative? And if you're a Russian citizen being granted a passport by the Russians, and you're living in Crimea, it could be that you'll have interest in going in another direction. But one wild card in this whole thing are the Tatars in Crimea, and that's about 10 to 12% of the population. These people were thoroughly abused by Stalin and the Soviet Union, and they remember it. I doubt very much they want to stick around or would support this. Replacing people with crooks, hardly an unusual playbook.
Well, but there are Ukrainians demonstrating in Crimea. They're getting the hell beaten out of them by these Russian thugs. The Russians are moving people across the borders. We don't know exactly how many of these eastern Ukrainians are really feeling so strongly about Russia's intervention or potential intervention in the east. My understanding is that in Ukraine, there is a certain amount of patriotism about their country, whether you speak Russian or Ukrainian. And in Russia, there's a great deal of disquiet about the idea of Russians and Ukrainians shooting each other. That there's deep familial and cultural ties between these two peoples.
Well, this may explain why Putin wants to move so fast on referenda. You move quickly, the information doesn't get out. This is a very fast-moving situation. And another problem he may be facing is that the instability that he's causing in the Ukraine and the Crimea may come home to roost. There are a lot of poor people in Russia and a lot of poor people upset about what's happening. And then there's Belarus. Belarus is getting hit right now economically because of the decline in the Ukrainian currency and the cost for importing Ukraine goods and their competitiveness. And again, there are a lot of poor people under a dictatorship in Belarus. Could this spread over to there? He's playing with fire now. If instability spreads in this part of the world, much like it did in the Arab Spring, we're in for a very interesting couple of years or more.
So what are the flashpoints beyond the Ukraine? You said Belarus?
Belarus, Moldova, not necessarily Romania. But within Russia, there could be many flashpoints of people, particularly in some of the republics and the oblasts, are unhappy with the inequality issues, the corruption, the power of the oligarchs, the inability of the Russian government to create meaningful jobs, how it's essentially a resource-based country. And also, these sorts of activities outside of the country, which are going to end up disturbing inside the country. When the stock market goes down and the ruble goes down, the stock market's going to mostly hit the richer people who actually invested in it, but it will cause job losses over time if this continues. When the ruble drops, that means everyone who has ruble-denominated assets in Russia gets hit. Not going to be too happy about that.
Well, Paul Sullivan, I thank you for giving us your briefing here on how the chips may fall. I appreciate it.
And thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and an adjunct professor in security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and future resource threats. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the granddaughter of the Soviet leader who gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954.